I'm Rod Finkel, President of the Council, and I welcome you today. Thank you for coming. As you know, we're a membership organization. We're a nonprofit membership organization with the purpose of providing subjects of world affairs interest. Our objective is to allow individuals to make up their own minds on any of the issues that are presented. Along that line, we solicit your membership and invite you to join us if you are not already a member. We have membership cards at the door. I'm told that there are representatives here from APU. Would you please stand all over there? Let's give them a hand. We have a strong student program, and in our endeavors to expand it, Nana Corporation sponsored 50 free memberships for our students. And Shell is also sponsoring another 65 students. So if there are any students here who would like 1 year's free membership, you may sign up for it at the door, as it's first come, first serve. Also, I want to thank BP. They provide us the resources where we can give our student guests a free meal. And we're glad they do it, and we're glad the students come. I want to thank Will Thur today, who is recording our program, which can be heard on the KSKA's programming, normally on Thursday evenings. You can also go to their website. There are 3x5 cards table on your table, and they're for the purpose of your questions. So after the presentation, we will collect the cards, and we will go through as many questions as we have time for. Would you please clearly print your question? Sometimes the challenge is just reading it, not answering it. I'd like to introduce our head table now. To my far left is Clyde Hutchins. He is a member of our board of directors, and he will be reading the questions after the presentation. Sitting next to him is Jean Kalantai, who is from the Alaskans for Palestine. And Jean will kindly introduce our guest speaker today.
Hello. Allison Weir is the founder and executive director of If Americans Knew, a nonpartisan think tank that works to provide information on Israel-Palestine to the American public. She is here on her first and not last Alaska speaking tour, sponsored by Alaskans for Palestine, working with the World Affairs Council. Tonight, also, there will be an evening event at the Lusac Library at the Wilde Marston Theater at 7 p.m. And this will be till 9, so there'll be even more time for her presentation and for questions and discussion. Allison speaks nationally and internationally, including lectures at Harvard Law School, the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, Stanford, Yale, the Naval Postgraduate Institute, two briefings on Capitol Hill, and three talks at the Asia Media Summit in Kuala Lumpur. Former U.S. Congressman Tom Campbell said of her talk, "Ms. Weir presents a powerful, well-documented view of the Middle East today. She is intelligent, careful, and critical. American policymakers would benefit greatly from hearing her firsthand observations and attempting to answer the questions that she poses." And to that, I would add that the American public would benefit very greatly. Ladies and gentlemen, we welcome Allison Weir.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be here. I'm honored to be in your beautiful state, and I'm so happy that some of you have come to hear me today. 9 years ago, I knew almost nothing about Israel-Palestine, At that time, I was the editor of a very small newspaper in Northern California, writing about the fishing fleet, the school district. The Middle East seemed distant, confusing, and irrelevant to my daily life. And so, like most Americans, I would skim the headlines on this issue, accept the confusion that I found, and I would move on. But then, in fall of 2000, I began to see those images of children throwing stones against tanks, and I finally decided to pay attention, to try to follow the news coverage and just learn what Israel-Palestine was all about. And when I did that, as a journalist, I noticed quickly that it seemed to me that we were getting a one-sided view, that we would hear from and about Israelis in great detail, as we should. And then when I waited and expected to hear from and about Palestinians as well, I noticed that came much less frequently. Today, therefore, my effort will be to tell something about what the media are leaving out. I won't take my very limited time to go into things that fortunately are reported by the American media. I'll try to give the other half of the equally significant news coverage. Now, as we know, many people allege that the media are biased. Sometimes those accusations are correct, sometimes they're not. We wanted to do a study, a sort of scientific study. My son is in physics and math. I like the idea of a study as immune to subjective bias as possible, something that would be quantifiable. We decided, and that would be a significant category. So we decided to study how the media were reporting on deaths among both populations. We especially focused on the first year because first impressions are so powerful. They determine for us who is the aggressor, who is defending their population. We used an Israeli organization to answer the very important question we needed to ask, because you cannot evaluate coverage if you don't know what's going on. So we needed to find out how many people were killed during that first year. Using an Israeli group, we discovered 165 Israelis had been killed by Palestinians, 549 Palestinians had been killed by Israelis. How were these deaths covered by our primetime network news shows? Well, we discovered that they were reporting on Israeli deaths at rates 3 and 4 times greater than they were reporting on Palestinian deaths. Next, we looked at a subcategory that is even more significant. All populations feel that children are illegitimate targets of strife. When children are killed, we are deeply saddened and horrified. It is especially newsworthy when this is going on. So we decided to do a study of that. And again, the first question was to discover how many children among both populations, they all matter. How many children among both populations were killed by the other? And we found that it was 28 Israelis, 131 Palestinian children. How were these tragic deaths covered by our primetime network news shows? Well, we found that they were reporting on Israeli children's deaths at rates up to 13 and 14 times greater than they were reporting on the equally tragic deaths of Palestinian children. Another way of looking at that is this chart, where the dark blue section of the Israeli column are the number of reports on Israeli children's deaths that exceeded the number that had actually occurred, making it appear to us that more are happening than really are because of the numerous follow-up reports on those deaths. In the Palestinian column, the red column, we see the opposite. We see a vast empty column of Palestinian children's deaths that were never even reported to us. We decided to graph our data chronologically as well. This is from our study of the New York Times. This first line is graphing the New York Times reporting on Israeli children's deaths during those first 12 months. Next, we'll graph the actual deaths of Israeli children during that first year. And as you can see, it's this light blue column, blue line, a little bit similar curve, a little bit lower, because the New York Times also had numerous follow-up reports on Israeli children. Next, we'll show the graph the line for the New York Times reporting on Palestinian children's deaths during that first year. And as you can see, it's this red line, a little bit lower than the reporting on and the deaths of Israeli children, but a similar curve. Next, we'll see the actual curve for Palestinian children who were killed that first year. And here it is. We found this pattern again and again. In 2004, our media were consistently telling us that the violence was reduced. Well, let us see how many children were killed to measure what that terminology tells us. Again, using an Israeli group, we discovered that 8 Israeli children were tragically killed by Palestinians, and 179 Palestinian children were tragically killed by Israelis. How was this covered? Again, we see the kind of distortion. And I'm sure, as you recall, this means that during 2004, when the violence was allegedly reduced, for the Israeli population, it was. There was considerably less death. Not zero, as we would have wished, but considerably less. However, for the Palestinian population, it was the opposite. Many more Palestinian children had been killed, and many more Palestinians of all ages had been killed from even the preceding years. So if only one population matters to you, it was reduced violence. NPR, many people feel, is maybe a more reliable source of information than commercial media. They have consistently been accused by pro-Israel groups of being pro-Palestinian in their coverage. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting did a study to find out if these accusations were correct. They found that actually it was the opposite, that once again NPR also was reporting on Israeli deaths in very high percentages, Palestinian deaths in very low percentages. This becomes even worse around the country. For example, we did a study of the San Jose Mercury News, the newspaper of Silicon Valley of Stanford University. We looked at front page headlines because many of us are so busy that we just see the front page headlines, especially for international news. But at least we feel we're keeping up with the big stories of the day. During that period, 121 Israelis were killed, 384 Palestinians were killed. How was this covered by front page headlines? They reversed it. While this was going on, this is what it looked like. This was one of our first studies, and I was astounded. It occurred to me that if the Mercury News had similarly reported the Super Bowl backwards or the World Series wrong, they would have had jokes being made about them around the country. And here they were committing a distortion of that magnitude having to do with lives and deaths, and no one noticed it. We learn about Palestinian weaponry and Israeli suffering in great detail. Suicide bombings are tragic on every possible level. When Palestinians wish to deliver a bomb, their only delivery system is to attach it to themselves. We know about Palestinian rockets. We are rarely told how many people those rockets actually kill. The fact is, most often they land in an empty field. In 8 years of using this weaponry, these rockets have killed a total of 18 people, 18 Israelis. We should also learn about Israeli weaponry being used against Palestinians. The Israeli military is at least the 5th most powerful military on the planet. It has hundreds of nuclear weapons. It has been using F-16s, Apache helicopter gunships, tanks of the highest quality against a population that is largely unarmed. We are rarely told this part of the story. The number of Israelis that have been killed since the uprising began in fall of 2000 is approximately 1,000. The number of Palestinians who have been killed by Israelis during that same period is over 6,000. We should not ask for pro-Israeli coverage or pro-Palestinian coverage. We should get the full picture. We're Americans. These are the numbers for the tragic deaths of children among both of those populations. As you may already be noticing, it is Palestinian children who were killed first. While the media consistently tell us that Israel is defending itself, is retaliating, the chronology is the reverse. 90 Palestinian children were killed before a single Israeli child was killed. For 3.5 months, Palestinian children were being killed before a single Israeli child was killed. 140 Palestinian men, women, and children were killed before a single Israeli in Israel was killed. Before the rockets had begun, before the suicide bombings. There is so much, of course, that's being omitted. This is just the tip of the iceberg. If we don't even know Palestinians are being killed in these numbers, and first, there's a great deal else, of course, that's also being filtered out of our news coverage. There is dissent in Israel. There are soldiers who feel they are patriotic Israeli citizens who are opposing what the government of Israel is doing. There are women's groups, there are rabbi groups, etc. There's considerable dissent. It is very significant, and we should know about it. So when we learn about Israeli governmental atrocities, it's very important to recognize this does not stand for all Israelis. It does not stand for all Israeli soldiers. But our media rarely tell us that. Similarly, many people that support Palestinians, perhaps, will say if only Palestinians would use nonviolence the way Gandhi did, the way Dr. Martin Luther King did. The reality is they do. There are nonviolent demonstrations by Palestinian citizens every week. There are at least 2 every week, often more. They are very courageous, and they are joined by people from around the world of all ethnicities, ages, and backgrounds, including Israelis. Some Israelis are joining these. It's a very important part of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and it is virtually going unreported to the American public. These are very courageous actions because quite a few people taking part in these have been killed, and many have been injured. 16 Palestinians taking part in nonviolent marches against the confiscation of their land have been killed. Some of those killed and injured have been Americans and Europeans and others. The next pictures I'll go through quickly during lunch. We don't want to see these, but the fact that nonviolent people are being so ruthlessly attacked by opponents should be known to us. This girl was 23 years old, 21 years old, 19, 36, 24. A very different kind of omission is this one. In 2003, on Capitol Hill, an independent commission that had investigated the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty reported its findings. Chairing that commission was Admiral Thomas Moorer, a 4-star admiral and the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. With Admiral Moorer was a rear admiral who had been the head of the whole legal department of the U.S. Navy. Part of the commission was General Ray Davis, Marine General, the highest-ranking Medal of Honor recipient in the United States. These gentlemen reported their findings about Israel's attack on a U.S. Navy ship that killed or injured 200 Americans. They reported that this had been an act of murder of Americans and an act of war against the United States, and that aspects of this attack had been ordered covered up by the White House and by the Secretary of Defense. Statements of that gravity made by officials of that high rank would normally be newsworthy. And yet, the New York Times, CNN, Fox News, ABC, none of them covered it. To read what they said, you can go to the Congressional Record, where it is located, or read the Stars and Stripes newspaper that did carry some of this information. The U.S. connection in some ways is the most significant omission of all. It is a huge world with important issues all over the world. It is hard to be informed on all of them. But if we are connected to an issue, we should know that. I feel morally, because if we are impacting other human lives, we should decide if we approve of the type of impact we are having or if we do not. From a self-interest point of view, it is also essential that we be well and accurately informed. Because again, if our government is negatively impacting other human beings, there is high probability that they will negatively impact us. For that reason, we should know especially about those types of issues. And in Israel-Palestine, we are a major player in what many people think is a two-way conflict. We are giving Israel $7 million per day of our tax money, more than we give to any other nation on earth, more than we give to all the starving countries of Africa put together. And since typically we give it at the start of the year, this means that since we have been operating at a deficit, we are borrowing the money that we give to Israel. So we give the money to Israel. We no longer have it, but we are paying interest on that money. Israel, on the other hand, does not spend it all at the beginning of the year. They bank it and they make interest off it. It is a bizarre system, and we should know about it. The history and context are rarely given, and when they are given, they are incorrect. I don't know about you, but I grew up with many myths about this issue. I've now researched it, and I found much of what I thought was true was false. I'll go through this very quickly because there's so little time, but the point of this list is that one must read widely to be sure that you're getting an honest history. We know that a book that may seem very scholarly may in actuality be omitting significant information. The author may have a political agenda of some sort. We don't know that if we don't read widely enough to make certain that we're getting the facts. It's important to read historians that are Israeli, Palestinian, American, Jewish, Christian, secular, British, European, etc. When you do that, the history is not complicated. I learned about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that when I was born, there was no Israel. There was a Palestine that had been a region for millennia, for certainly centuries. So where did this conflict come from if there wasn't even an Israel when I was born? You just go back to the late 1800s, and you find that Palestine was under the Ottoman Empire. It was inhabited by a somewhat multicultural population, 80% Muslim, 15% Christian, about 5% Jewish. All living on that land that is holy to all three of them, practicing their religion, and living in peace for centuries. So what happened? Well, you go to Europe in the late 1800s, and you find the beginning of a political movement called Zionism, in which there was the goal to create a Jewish state somewhere in the world. Uganda was considered, Argentina, parts of North America. They finally settled on Palestine because of biblical connections from 2,000 years before, despite the fact that this was a highly secular movement and was opposed by almost all observant Jews at the time, including those in Palestine. Immigration to Palestine increased over the decades, and not surprisingly, but very sadly, there was violence between the two groups, the indigenous people, 95% of whom were to be pushed out, and the colonizers. Over the decades, as the immigration increased, especially under the Nazi Holocaust and the atrocities going on in Europe, the immigration increased still further, and so the violence between the two groups increased still further. Finally, after World War II, Britain, which now had the mandate for Palestine, decided to give up and turn the question of Palestine over to the United Nations to solve. At this point, the United Nations could have affirmed its bedrock principle of democracy, self-determination of peoples. They could have allowed the people to vote and set up their own government, finally, instead of being under someone's empire. But instead of doing that, under considerable pressure from Zionists, threats, and bribes, the General Assembly voted to a partition recommendation in which 55% of Palestine would be given to a Jewish state. Despite the fact that even after decades of immigration, the Jewish population had become only 30% of the population and owned at most 8% of the land, and yet was given 55%. Rather than decreasing the violence, such an unjust recommendation increased the violence, and there was outright war. Israel calls this its war of independence. Palestinians call it the catastrophe, al-Nakba, because it was a massive humanitarian catastrophe. At least 750,000 people, a very large proportion of the entire Palestinian population, was pushed off their land. Israeli forces committed numerous massacres, and at the end of this war, 1947 to 1949, Israel existed on 78% of Palestine. In 1967, Israel attacked its neighbors again and began its occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Since that time, Israel has begun moving portion of its population onto these occupied territories. This is illegal under international law. Every one of those red dots in the West Bank represents a Jewish-only colony. Our media call it a settlement. Many other languages, the word is colony. These are, as I said, illegal. In the Gaza Strip, those red dots have been removed. Now the land has been returned to its rightful owners. But it is largely a concentration camp. Israel controls all of the borders. The border with Egypt, Egypt allegedly controls, but it largely does what Israel and the United States tell it to do. As a result, it has been largely sealed off for several years now. Before that, it was partially sealed off. People are unable to receive the amount of food that they need, the amount of medical supplies, building materials, all are being heavily restricted to 1.5 million people living within what's very much a prison. When I began to learn all of this late in my life, in 2000, it began to seem that things were extremely different than I had thought they were. And it seemed, in fact, so significant to me that I decided, since I was a journalist, I would go and see for myself. I would be a freelance reporter. I quit my job in Sausalito and began the most unusual trip I have ever undertaken. Many years before, I had been in the Peace Corps in Afghanistan. In that case, I had a very official support system behind me, the Peace Corps. In this case, I was going to be traveling alone, and I had no organization sponsoring me or helping me whatsoever. As I landed on February 7th, 2001, I wondered what it was going to be like for me as a single female American to wander alone through a Muslim land that was in the middle of a violent uprising and that was at the very epicenter of a region portrayed widely as extremely hostile to Americans in general and to women in particular. I discovered that in actuality, as I traveled randomly and very haphazardly throughout Gaza and the West Bank, that these were but two more false myths. I was welcomed. I was invited to stay in people's homes. I was treated with respect and completely safe. Whenever people learned I was an American, and I always told them that, the invariable response was welcome. And yet we consistently see images in which Palestinians appear to be dangerous terrorists. If you'll look at this picture, you'll see these photojournalists taking this photograph. I'm afraid I ruined it for them because I took all of the pictures that you're seeing, and I was standing right next to this person under no danger whatsoever. This was a symbolic gesture in which a cardboard box was being burned in a funeral for a small boy who had been killed the day before. We should see those pictures. I have shown them to you. But it seems to me we should also see what most of those people in that funeral looked like. This girl said to me, "Do you think we're all terrorists? Because Palestinians are very aware that's what we are being led to believe about them." I think we should also see these people. These are Palestinian Christians. That is my background as well. And I would ask Palestinian Christians, how is this for you? You're a very small minority in a largely Muslim population. Is this extremely difficult? What's going on? They would all look at me and just say, "We're all Palestinians. We're all Palestinians, and we are all being pushed out by Israel." This is their son George holding a fragment of the Israeli missile that came through their wall. As I was going through this area in 2001 and on trips since, I found that Palestinians were living largely in little prisons within larger ones. You could not get out of your village. You could not go to the next village over to go to work, to go to school, to go to the hospital, to deliver your baby. In some parts, it was even worse. They were being shelled nightly. As I went through this area, this is the Tufa area of Khan Yunis in Gaza, I found that entire residential neighborhoods were bullet-riddled. As I went through this area, there was at one point suddenly Israeli gunfire near me. At first, I thought it was a coincidence, but then I realized that actually, of course, as I was going around this area and I could see those Israeli guard towers overlooking us, those Israeli soldiers could see that a foreigner was walking around. And I think they finally decided to send her a message. "Don't come here. Don't see what we are doing." I saw in Gaza beautiful agricultural land being destroyed. I saw entire neighborhoods that were being wiped out. I talked to women who had homes who were, had been, one woman had had two homes and she was not allowed, her homes had been destroyed. They were living in tin shanties and tents in the dirt. I saw a population and a land that was being destroyed. To me, that's newsworthy. At one point, I was sitting with a woman in the dirt, because these tents don't have floors, and she gave me sweet mint tea and asked me to tell Americans about her. I told her I would try. And I saw more. I don't like seeing suffering. I don't like seeing children in pain. But since thousands of children have been injured through the use of my tax money, it was my job to see them. And all I had to do was go to the nearest hospital. I saw children with bullets in their backs, in their stomachs, in their teeth, in their heads. I saw a brain-dead 12-year-old. His crime was throwing stones at invading soldiers. I saw children who will never walk again. They won't skip, they won't frolic, their childhoods are finished. I saw parents who were happy to see me because they thought that as an American, maybe I could help their poor, destroyed son. I asked the doctor if maybe I could help arrange medical care of some sort. He explained to me that he had not yet found the right time and the right way to tell the parents, but that their son was totally and eternally paralyzed. And I knew something they didn't know. And I wished I didn't. And now you do too. That's what I saw in Gaza. And then I went to the West Bank and visited a newspaper office. They said a 9-year-old boy was just shot nearby. Maybe you'd like to go see. And I thought, no, I wouldn't like to go see, but I did. And I took photographs of his blood. I went up to see where he had been sitting watching his father paint the wall. I saw the wet paint, the toy trucks, the blood on the floor. I saw the wall hanging in the living room that had a bullet hole in it that said, "Thinking of God makes our hearts grow calm." I saw the needlepoint over the front door that said, "God bless our home." The family had moved in 10 days before. I saw the flowers in the living room and the family photos on the wall. I saw the parents when they returned from the hospital. I heard the mother and sisters weeping and weeping. I saw the father walking around, shell-shocked. It looked like he was sleepwalking in a bad dream that will never end. I saw the neighbors come in to comfort them. At one point, when it appeared that the father was finally going to break down, I heard a man tell him, "Your son is a bird in heaven now." The next day, I went to the funeral, and the next day, another funeral. This one was for a woman who had been killed the day before and had three sons, 18, 14, and 12. I talked to a woman who was the dead woman's neighbor and who told me that just this woman had gone to school, college in the U.S. Just a few days before, the dead woman had been asking her what it was like to go to college in the U.S. because she said her 18-year-old son wanted to go to college in the United States. This woman explained to me that it's every boy's dream in Palestine to go to college in the U.S. She said, "Of course he won't go now. He'll stay home to help with his brothers." And then I visited Bethlehem, and I saw destroyed homes and pictures of children that had been in those homes and been killed. And I remembered walking through Rafah in southern Gaza and seeing bullet-riddled homes there and talking with people. And I remember one family asked me why America was doing this to them. And I found it difficult to answer their questions because I was so tired of telling people, "Americans don't know what we're doing to you. Our media don't tell us." The only time that I saw Palestinian guns that were to be used for something other than signaling bravado in a funeral was in another part of Rafah at a sandbag barricade, where I saw boys and men I saw Israeli armored vehicles and tanks starting to move in, and I saw boys and young men gathering to throw stones against those tanks. And then I noticed that three of those young men had guns. They asked me not to take their picture, so I did not. I also did not take pictures of the Israeli soldiers. As you've noticed, it felt unsafe to do that, so I didn't. But I wish I had. I wish I could show you those pictures, and I wish I could show you these Palestinian gunmen, as our media call them. And maybe you could decide about these young gunmen, how dangerous they were or desperate, how courageous they were or foolish, how suicidal they were or patriotic. I don't know. And maybe you can figure out why we keep buying their conquerors newer and bigger weapons. This is some of what I saw in Palestine, but it's not what I saw when I returned to the Sausalito Library and took out every San Francisco Chronicle that had been published while I was there, went through each story one by one. I was appalled at what had been considered news coverage. I read only headline after headline about an Israel under siege. I had spent time in Israel. I had joined throngs of shoppers, ridden buses, gone to a cafe and sipped a cappuccino. And I had thought about what was going on just out of sight, just a little ways away. I noticed that on the very day that 9-year-old Obai was killed, that the San Francisco Chronicle did not have room to report on, they had published a story, a very long story, about children who were tragically killed 50 years before in an earlier Holocaust, one that it is too late for the world to prevent. Instead of telling us about what is going on now, that we, if we chose to, could stop. One night I was in Gaza and I sat down to write another news story about what I had seen that day. But instead, I wrote a letter to Americans back home. I'll read it to you now. "Come to Palestine and see how your tax dollars are spent. Visit a hospital with me and see a boy with a bullet hole in his back. See children with scared eyes and legs that don't work anymore, a terrified old man whose neck is swathed in bandages from the bullet that passed through it as he sat in his home drinking his tea. Come with me and visit mothers of dead, injured, gone children, thousands of them, and tell them how you didn't know we supplied the weapons that ripped flesh, broke bones, destroyed lives. Talk to old women who are made to kowtow to Uzi-toting 19-year-olds who tell them, no, you can't go to visit your son today. No, you can't take a drive in the country. No, you can't go to the hospital and have your chemotherapy, your dialysis, your operation, and watch as they die. Come to the borders with me, invisible lines in the sand between towns that Israel has drawn with its tanks and helicopters and 200 nuclear weapons, and watch the women with difficult births deliver dead babies and then die themselves at military checkpoints, death points, when soldiers with their ultimate power decide not to let them pass. Listen to these young warriors with their lethal weapons and deadly tempers proclaim, we've decided to close this road, and if you don't like it, we'll shoot you, as we already have 10,000 of your countrymen. Don't look at us wrong, or we'll shoot out your eyes, as we have 28 of your children. We're not cruel. We left 27 of them with one eye. Go home, Arab, and wait, and pray we don't decide to shell it, as we have thousands of those others who were in our way, with the wonderful singing missiles the U.S. gives us. Go harvest your crops, Arab, until we decide to bulldoze your 100-year-old date palms and ancient olive groves, your strawberry fields forever gone. Come to Palestine, Americans, and see your tax dollars at work, millions and millions of them, every day, every day, and weep with me for our victims and our guilt, and then say, no more. Thank you.
If you will, please write your questions out in the card. And we'll have our people go through the audience and pick them up. If your card does not get noticed, please raise your hand and we'll get it. Clyde, would you do the honor with the first question? We will go as long as we can, but when we're out of time, we're out of time.
Okay, the first question. Who and what do you believe is behind the media bias in favor of Israel?
That's a very good question. I think that part of it is fairly complicated. I think there are a number of factors, and some of those I have on this slide. One of the significant factors I think some of you maybe have experienced here is there is a great deal of pressure against having information about Israel-Palestine get out to the American media. So, for example, if a newspaper or a radio station just starts to report at least a little of that, they are hit with massive well-orchestrated consumer boycotts. They cause great damage to NPR affiliates in Boston, for example. They organize boycotts against the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune. None of these outlets were even remotely doing good journalism, much less over in the direction of pro-Palestinian journalism. But they had had a few stories that were giving some of the facts, so they got hit with considerable financial pressure. Advertisers would threaten and would cancel advertising. People that are very wealthy use their considerable wealth and power to try to prevent Americans from getting the facts. This plays, I expect, a role in the media. Those are businesses. If they are going to lose a lot of money and lose their livelihood and can't pay their bills, then quite likely they will do what they have to do. That's no doubt a part of it. A second factor is probably there are pro-Israel owners and journalists around. We know that people are human beings, and some will unintentionally or intentionally bias the news. Some of them have a strong track record of being very pro-Israel. For example, Mortimer Zuckerman, Wolf Blitzer, Jeffrey Goldberg. That may be a factor of some significance. There's also, I would guess, more important is that the Associated Press system is very questionable, the way it reports. There's one control bureau. Let me explain it. I'm sorry to take the time, but there are four bureaus in Israel-Palestine. Two of them are in Israel. Two of them are in the Palestinian territories. That's good. That sounds very excellent way to do it. The two bureaus in Israel are staffed largely, perhaps sometimes exclusively, by Jewish and Israeli journalists living in Israel. That's good. They will be connected to the population, speak the language, get the stories for us. The two bureaus in the West Bank and Gaza, one each, are similarly staffed with Palestinian journalists, Christian and Muslim. That's good. They will be plugged in, will speak the language, will get us the stories. Why, then, is AP giving us 7 times more reporting on Israeli children's deaths than Palestinian children's deaths? Well, in every region of the world, one of the bureaus through which everything is funneled and or filtered, they choose one of them as a control bureau. In this case, I imagine you can guess whether the control bureau is one of the Palestinian ones or one of the Israeli ones. It is one of the Israeli ones, and I think that's a factor.
Okay, and I had a couple more questions along those lines. Somebody was asking about the military-industrial complex idea. How does that play into this mix?
Interestingly, although as we know, as Eisenhower told us many years ago, I remember Ike, that's a significant factor quite often. In this case, I don't think it is. In this case, the military-industrial complex usually loses out when it comes into conflict with the Israel lobby, which happens fairly often. So at the beginning, at the very beginning, back in the 47 period and before, mainly 47, but for years before that too, the Pentagon and the State Department were consistently writing memos and that supporting the Zionist ambitions would be very damaging to the United States. That this could be only sustained by warfare, the U.S. would be drawn into it, would be bad for the U.S., which already had excellent relations with the Arab world. So they opposed it. General George Marshall, who was Secretary of State under Harry Truman, told his president, "Don't sacrifice U.S. interests just for the sake of an election." Harry Truman said, "Gentlemen, I have hundreds of thousands of people who are eager for the state of Israel. I don't have hundreds of thousands of Arabs among my constituents." So in many cases, the military-industrial complex has lost out. And at one point, Israel was trying to develop a fighter jet called the Lviv fighter. They got massive amounts of money from the U.S. Congress, which does really whatever their campaign donors tell them to do, or what they're afraid their campaign donors will switch to their opponent. So they got the Lviv fighter in Israel was getting massive amounts of money with almost no oversight. Overrun after overrun, it was a complete boondoggle. During those same years, Boeing was trying to get money out of our Congress for developing an aircraft. They weren't able to get it. So this is something of a measure of the type of thing that's been going on for many decades.
This question is asking your thoughts about the idea that Hamas has been democratically elected and uses humanitarian aid for Palestinians to help their attacks against Israelis. And the question is, why does this occur? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the question I find a little muddy, but I'll be happy to address, I think, what's at heart. Hamas was democratically elected. It was the Reform Party. Under Fatah, which had considerable corruption, the conditions, no matter what they had done, I think this would have happened, but conditions for Palestinians grew worse and worse. Israeli forces were killing Palestinians, were taking their land. Nothing was getting better. It was getting a lot worse. So Hamas came in that had a reputation for not being corrupt. It had had a lot of, in addition to, it does have a military wing, but it also has a very large just political wing. It had clinics that it put on, schools, etc. Some of the candidates that ran as part of the Hamas party were Christians. So Hamas won the election. That was democratically elected.
Okay, this is just a small question about the source for your statistics. You said something about an Israeli source. Can you tell us what that is?
Yes, thank you. All of our statistics and much, much more is on our website. website. And we've made our website very transparent, so people, you can click on it, and you can see where our information is coming from and follow it all the way through and get more and more in-depth the more you go. So the statistics, for example, about the deaths that we were using for our studies were coming from an Israeli human rights organization called B'Tselem. It gathers statistics on both Israeli deaths and Palestinian deaths in great detail. So if you go to our website and go from that to the B'Tselem, you can get, you know, the name of the child or the person, where they were killed, where in the body it was, so you can get even more about it. If anything, truthfully, they undercount the Palestinian deaths. Not intentionally at all, I don't, you know, but because they confirm every death, and it's more difficult for them, since they're located in Israel, it's more difficult to confirm every death in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society, which I feel is a very reliable source, has slightly higher numbers for the deaths. So if anything, we are making the media look even better than they are.
What do you think America should do, and what part should they play in improving things in that region?
Thank you for that question. I think that we should stop our tax money from going to Israel. We certainly have considerable need here, which is something to be concerned about. In addition, I feel that the tax money to Israel is preventing a solution because it is giving the militarists my father is in the military, so I'm not anti-military, but giving the people that think that they can truthfully just ethnically cleanse the population they don't want around, the power to say we don't have to compromise. We have all the power because we've got a blank check from an uninformed American public to do whatever we want. The more rational people in Israel that are saying, no, we need to compromise, we need to have a legitimate peace process for once, are disempowered by our massive aid to Israel. When we stop our aid to Israel, Israel will still be very powerful. We won't take, you know, that enormous military away from them, but people are pragmatic. And the leadership and the people who choose the leadership will see that that was a failed policy. And now the Israelis who have been saying, we need to meet honestly with Palestinians and negotiate how we will find a solution. We'll meet with the many Palestinians who are very eager and also are visionaries. We'll negotiate a peace at that point when they are both motivated to find peace. And either it will be one state with equal rights for all people, which is what most of us believe in, or it will be perhaps two states, hopefully of equal size, power, and sovereignty. But it's up to them to choose what they will do, and up to us to stop interfering with the process that so badly needs to go forward.
You had talked earlier about the 1967 conflict, and here's a question asking, wasn't Israel attacked first in that conflict?
Thank you. I'm so glad that question was asked, because no, it wasn't. Even Israel doesn't claim that. So anybody who is saying that is believing what Israel first said. Israel often changes its story. You know, many governments do this. But Israel, at the beginning of that war, told its good ally, the United States, that they had been attacked first by Egypt. Well, that was false. They had taken out the whole Egyptian Air Force on the ground. They called it a preemptive attack. That's what pro-Israel people, if they've done their homework, that's the one they say. But it was actually a preemption of peace, because Nasser was actually sending out peace feelers right there trying to defuse the situation, because Nasser had no interest really in fighting for Palestinians. Those are not Egyptians. So Israel attacked first and caused considerable destruction. And in fact, some people feel that the attack on the USS Liberty, which was a surveillance ship gathering transmissions in the area, that one of the reasons for that attack might have been that we would learn right then that Israel had not been attacked, that they had initiated the aggression. Because we had said if they were attacked, we would protect them. And plus, they were about to enlarge the war, and we were calling for a ceasefire, so they probably didn't want us to know that either. And while I'm on the Liberty, the third possibility, well, there's another few others, but one of the other possibilities about why they attacked the ship is that if they had sunk the ship with every man aboard, which they tried very hard to do, after they'd knocked out the antennas, they were still trying to sink the ship, torpedoed it, machine-gunned everybody, shot up stretcher bearers. These are war crimes. If they had succeeded in that goal, we would have thought it was Egypt. And it is quite likely that we would have entered the war and would have attacked Egypt.
Okay, this is a question about the funding for your organization. Do you track the donations? Can you explain a little bit about who funds the organization?
That's right. Thank you for this question, because we subsist on donations, and that's one of the hardest parts. So we get donations on our website. We're fully tax deductible. People can mail them. I think I put the address somewhere here, but I forgot to do it before. But anyway, we have occasionally gotten grants from small sort of anti-racism kind of foundations. So we've gotten a few of those. But mostly it's donations from individuals.
In view of your comments about the slanted journalism, what advice do you have for young journalists in the United States?
I'm glad to hear that. Maybe that was from a young journalist. My daughter is a young journalist. She has a master's degree in journalism. So I believe in journalism. I think, as our mission statement says, that a democracy cannot exist if it doesn't have a strong, free press. It's so important that our founding fathers put it in the First Amendment. So I think it's very important, and I think that it's not, you know, again, in terms of giving advice to young people, it's not something you're likely to make a great deal of money at, I should warn you. But I think it's very important, very rewarding work. And I think that the more people that go into it with the intention and the commitment to do principled, honest journalism, the better off our nation will be.
Okay, here's a question asking about the idea of Hamas using children as shields, and how much of your statistics on deaths of children in Palestine reflect children being used as shields?
Yeah. This is another one of these myths that Israel puts out, and some people happily repeat. You know, it's very unlikely that a population is going to put its children out for shields. You know, do we think people in other parts of the world are not the same human beings that we are? No, this is not happening. You know, I've spent a lot of time there. There have been thorough studies of that accusation, and it is completely false. There was, if any of you know, probably have heard about the Goldstone report that just came out about the onslaught against Gaza. It's almost 600 pages, written by a Jewish South African journalist who's a very respected legal scholar, who wrote almost 600, his commission wrote out almost 600 pages, disproved those types of fairly repugnant accusations, detailed a great deal of what went on. And of course, is being attacked by Israel, and the U.S. goes along with Israel and is trying to prevent his recommendations from being considered. But I recommend people read that report.
What are other Arab countries doing to try to end this conflict diplomatically?
Many people feel they're not doing enough. Many have taken in a lot of the refugees. Jordan is half Palestinian now. Imagine if the U.S. were half Canadian. So many have, you know, a lot of the refugees have gone there and are living there. But they have, militarily, I think the accurate analysis is there's really very little they can do. Because Israel has, as I said, a very powerful military with hundreds of nuclear weapons. They also have the U.S., because of the power of the Israel lobby, pretty much doing, you know, they're on the side of Israel. So it would be suicidal for any Arab country to try to intervene militarily, which is one reason that they don't try to do that. There was one time that they actually fought militarily Egypt and Syria just to get their own land back in 1973, they did that one thing. So there's little they can do militarily. Now they can, what they could do is use the wealth that some of those nations have to try to use that as a tool to to bring sort of resolution. That's done a little bit, but not very much. Now, on the other hand, in terms of changing policies, very little is done. It's certainly very, very little that's effective. In terms of humanitarian aid, massive amounts of humanitarian aid go from Arab countries to the people of Gaza and the West Bank. Right now, Israel's preventing much of that from getting to the people in Gaza, but it's this humanitarian aid from Arab countries and from the rest of the world that has basically kept the population in Gaza and the West Bank somewhat less miserable than they would be otherwise.
Do you have a sense of how the Israeli population living in Israel feels about this situation?
Yes, they're very third-class citizens. This is another aspect of the situation of Israelis, Palestinians. So the Israel calls them Israeli Arabs. They are Palestinian Christians and Muslims who managed to remain within Israel even after the 47-49 sort of expulsion of most of them. I'll be happy to get to the question. But it's good to know about this population because many of them, even though they're allegedly Israeli citizens, can't even live in their homes. They were pushed out of homes during the war. After the war, they were designated present absentees, which means they're present, but they're, quote, absentees, so the government of Israel has confiscated their homes and their villages and doesn't allow them to live in them. They are, for the most part, very sympathetic to their Palestinian brothers and sisters in the West Bank and Gaza. And in some cases, those are literally their brothers and sisters. They're extended families, so they have families over in those areas and are considerably sympathetic to them. During the early days of the uprising that began in 2000 and 2001, there were some demonstrations against the Israeli government for the ruthless way they were putting down that uprising. And I believe it was 13 Palestinian Israelis were killed by Israeli forces.
Well, how do the Israelis, as far as people of Israel nationality feel, if you know?
Sorry.
Israelis. In the sense of people who have Israeli passports, people living in the central section of Israel, how do they feel about the situation outside?
Oh yeah,
in Gaza and West Bank.
That's right. Israeli citizens are like in this country. You know, there are different groups who feel different ways. There is, as I mentioned at the beginning, but I'm glad to make sure people remember this part. There are a number of Israeli groups who feel very bad and actually horrified at what Israeli forces are doing in the West Bank and Gaza and at the siege of Gaza being done by the Israeli government. So there's rabbis for human rights that try to oppose that. There's a group called Israelis Against Home Demolitions. Israeli forces have destroyed thousands and thousands of Palestinian homes. So this group, Israelis Against Home Demolitions, have gone and sometimes actually put their bodies in front of the bulldozers to try to prevent that kind of destruction. There are these soldiers that have refused to serve in occupying forces. So there is that dissent. Sadly, though, the majority, you know, are voting for example, Netanyahu, who has a history of being very opposed to peace and feeling that Israel can just keep using its military might to try to elude doing justice. So, you know, it's hard to quite understand sometimes why people will support different policies. But sometimes it is through fear and through media that are censored. The Israeli media are censored to a degree, even though they have more information about all of this than we do. There still is military censorship. 60% of the Israeli public serves in the military, so many people have served there. Their brothers and husbands and various people have served in the occupied territories, so it's hard to believe they don't know what's going on. But some of them probably don't know what's going on, so there's sort of a mixture there.
This question is about the data that is used in your report. Do you know whether or not this trend that you show today is continuing into 2009?
We haven't done more recent media studies, so I don't know. Certainly the deaths have, you know, the deaths that I've shown you between Israelis and Palestinians, that trend, if anything, it's getting larger and larger. The number of Palestinians killed is growing larger. Unfortunately, the number of Israelis killed has remained very, very small. In the Gaza conflict, as they call it, 1,400 Gazans were killed and 9 Israelis. Of those 9 Israelis, 3 were civilians. There were other Israelis killed in friendly fire, but our statistics are always about those killed by the other side. So that part is continuing, that trend. As far as the media coverage, I think that it in some ways has gotten slightly better because so many of us are waking up and there is the internet and we have more access to learning the facts from other sources. But overall, I still consistently see omission and distortion and spin in the place of real news reporting. So I think that is continuing.
This question is about some remarks on your website about Zionists working with Nazis to create the Jewish homeland. Can you comment on that?
Yes, that's a very important aspect. There have been several books on this. Lenny Brenner is one of the major authors who, you know, most of the authors are Jewish. Hannah Arendt wrote about it. It was a scandal in Israel. Zionists were a fanatic ideology, as I said. Ben-Gurion, who is the, you know, sort of the founding father in some senses of the Israeli state, said at one point that if he could save, and he was talking about the Nazi Holocaust in Europe, he was saying if he could save all the Jewish children but not be able to create Israel, or if he could save only half but create Israel, he would save only half. So with that kind of fanaticism, the Zionist leadership did work with Adolf Eichmann. There was a transfer agreement that was made. So there's a lot of detailed information about this. We have some on our website. To get more details, you'd really need to read the books, which we also give the titles of on our website. And as I said, when this came out in Israel, people were extremely angry about that.
This question is about the solution to the current conflict, and someone is asking what would happen if the U.S. made continuing the annual aid to Israel contingent on Israel absorbing the local Palestinian population.
Well, that could be a way, that could be a policy that might be a good one. You know, if they were actually held to that, then in a way we would sort of, you know, give them money to make them do the right thing. So maybe that's what, you know, our population might choose to do that. Once we're informed, I assume we'll have votes and people should decide what they prefer, and maybe that's a good plan. I personally am reluctant to send any more money over there. We've sent massive amounts of money there. I go around the country and I see schools that are being closed down and veterans that are in substandard veterans hospitals and, you know, a great deal of need. So I would be, I personally would have to be really convinced that was the only way to bring it about. But it could be a reasonable policy.
This question is about the deaths of the Palestinian children. And the question is whether a lot of the deaths are caused by lack of the parents supervising the children, or is it actually that the children are being targeted by Israeli soldiers?
Sometimes they're being targeted by Israeli soldiers. There have been Israeli reports that have shown that. There are Israeli soldiers groups called Breaking the Silence, for example, in which soldiers will tell about what they had done. You know, now they're having nightmares about it, or what they know that their, you know, squad members did. So in some cases that has gone on. There was an article in the Israeli media by a very good Israeli journalist who had talked to soldiers who said, we're told 12 and above, we can shoot them 12 and above. Some are shooting smaller, younger than that. So sometimes that's going on. In other cases, Gaza is one of the densest places on earth. So if you drop a bomb there, as they did, you know, a two-ton bomb some years ago, then they kill, you kill 17 sleeping children. You know, it's a very, very densely populated place. It's, you know, and however, you know, I would talk to parents who, you know, when I remember one child when I was in, had first gotten over there, gave me a slingshot. And I took it back. I was staying with a family and showed it to them, and they all laughed because now I had a Palestinian weapon. But then the woman, the mother, looked very serious, and she said, "My son made one of those, and I took it away from him and put it in the top of the closet because I don't want him out there. You know, if soldiers are going to come nearby, I don't want him anywhere near." So, you know, if you're very poor and you have large families, and the father is in prison, there are 11,000 Palestinians in prison, 11,000. So if the father is in prison, sometimes the mother is too, then maybe there's not sufficient supervision of those children. And maybe they do go out with their slingshot and get blown away.
Okay, this question is about the idea that Hamas is labeled a terrorist organization by much of the Western world. And so the question is, why are you sort of defending them as opposed to Israel?
I don't defend terrorism. I don't think that it is right to kill civilians or children. I think when you kill soldiers, that's also equally tragic for those families, so I don't think killing is good in general. I think that if we are going to define things as terrorism, and we should, then a great deal of what the Israeli government is terrorism, far more than Hamas. Both parties have killed civilians. Israel has killed far more civilians and killed them first. Goldstone just showed that to be the case in Gaza. So I think that this definition and whatever is attached to it should apply to both. And that's what Goldstone found, that Hamas had committed some, quote, war crimes. Their war crimes consisted of, now that's how the New York Times reported it, Goldstone finds Israel and Hamas guilty of war crimes. The fact is that Hamas's war crimes consisted of using homemade rockets that didn't have guidance systems because they don't have them, and killing three Israeli civilians. That was their war crimes. And the Israeli war crimes were for intentionally killing hundreds and hundreds of civilians, etc.
Allison, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we're out of time. I would just like to make a little presentation to give something to Allison to remember us from Alaska. Thank you very much. And to inform... Our program next week is not on Friday. It's on Thursday, October 15th, and it's in the evening here at the hotel. And it will feature the Council General of Israel to the Pacific Northwest, Council Avikatur, who will speak on challenge and opportunities for peace in the Middle East today. Thank you all for coming.